Right, if we can start the meeting, if people can settle down a bit. My name's Liz Ratchew. I'll be chairing the meeting tonight. I'm a member of the Socialist Workers' Party in Islington. I'm also a teacher in Islington as well. Tonight I'd like to introduce John Pilger, who many of you will be familiar with. He's been a long-standing investigative journalist. He's made documentaries, the most recent of which was a documentary called Inside Burma, which was shown on television not so long ago. He's also made documentaries on Cambodia and East Timor, as well as making films and writing books. John is going to speak for around about 35 minutes, and whilst he's speaking, there'll be stewards wandering around the room holding up speaker slips for people to make contributions, or if you simply want to ask a question, then just write one down and hand it back in to one of the stewards. We do this to try and encourage the widest possible debate, and we'll take as many of the contributions as we have time for. So I'd like to introduce John Pilger.
Thank you. It's good to be addressing Marxism again. The title of this is very loosely The Hidden Power of the Media. It's very loose, but it's meant, I hope, to explain something of how I see the media from inside. Now, some years ago, before the collapse of the Soviet Union, a group of Russian journalists toured Britain and the United States, and they were astonished to find, after reading all the newspapers and watching all the television, that all the opinions were the same on all the vital issues. Now, in our country, they said to their host, to get that result, we have a dictatorship. We imprison people. We tear out their fingernails. Here you have none of that. How do you do it? What's the secret? Well, the secret, of course, is that propaganda in liberal democracies, like America and Britain, is much more thorough than in dictatorships and totalitarian states. No imprisonment is required, no loss of fingernails called for. There is another, far more effective way. Unlike totalitarian states, the conformity of information and opinion is insidious. Its sameness implicit, ingrained, and even celebrated. Now, in the former Soviet Empire, the promotion of sameness was an obligation that journalists grew deeply cynical about. And like in the West, they knew exactly what they were doing, and the public knew too. In 1977, I went to Czechoslovakia at the time of the birth of Charter 77, the resistance movement inside Czechoslovakia, and I met the banned Czech novelist, Zdeněk Urbanek, who told me this. In the East, we have acquired the skill of reading between the lines. In the West, you don't have this skill because you believe you don't need it. But you do need it more than we do because illusions are more effective than the censor at his desk. Now, what he was saying was that the abuse of conceptual thought and language and logic that exists in totalitarian states also exists in free society, and that only the form and illusions are different. Today there's another dimension to this, and it's called technology. Technology seems to have made almost anything possible except truth. And by truth I mean that which is subversive, for truth is always subversive. Otherwise, why should governments and their bureaucracies fear it so much and go to such lengths as to suppress it? And when the great American muckraking reporter I.F. Stone remarked that all governments are liars and nothing they say should be believed, he was exaggerating, of course, but not by much. What he was saying was that all unaccountable power is the enemy of truth, regardless of its democratic pretensions. Now, these days, we are constantly told we live in an information society. On the contrary, I believe we live in a media society in which there may appear to be saturation information, but But in reality, it's information that is repetitive, controlled, and above all, safe. When you next read the fashionable word debate, consider the extreme narrowness of its political and economic terms. When you next turn on the TV and radio, or pick up a newspaper, consider all the news you don't see and you don't read, news that is, by its very nature, unwelcoming, threatening, and therefore excluded. In my experience, the most powerful form of censorship is not by commission, the editor, the censor behind his desk, but by omission. Leaving out what it finds unpalatable, the Western media carries more or less the same ideological message as the Russian tourists found out. And that is that there's only one way for societies to develop. This is called the free market, and it's led by economic growth, although it has nothing to do with freedom and nothing to do with a true market and nothing to do with the growth of democracy and prosperity for the majority, let alone all. Yesterday, the United Nations Development Programme released an extraordinary report that showed the enormous divisions opening up in humanity, that the wealth of the world's 358 billionaires now exceeded the annual incomes of half the people on Earth, that since 1970, the provision of clean running water has dropped by two-thirds in poor countries, and that instead of true economic growth that benefits everybody, there is, and I quote, unprecedented jobless growth, ruthless growth, and anti-democratic growth. Strong words for a UN agency. Last night on News at 10, which is the principal source of information for millions of people in this country, there was not a word about this. The main news was Princess Diana suffering depression. It's only 15 million. At the bottom of the news was an item on Ireland, which presented the British Army and the RUC caught between two warring tribes, an enduring distortion. There was, of course, nothing about the UN report in the newspapers that between them sell more than any others in this country. The Mirror and the Sun concentrated on the love life of the golfer Nick Faldo. The Mirror's campaigning spirit, however, is not completely lost. Today it begins a campaign to get back Princess Diana's title of HRH. A few years ago, Rupert Murdoch's London correspondent gave us a rare glimpse of how the media high priests view themselves. He described Murdoch as a free market Karl Marx. Murdoch's empire, he wrote, has always shared one thing with Marxist enterprise. It turns ideas into social and economic experiments. He described Sky Television's takeover of televised football as part of this, and I quote, part of a social and ideological transformation of society in the image of a radical philosophy, unquote. Now, what this means simply is that media giants like Murdoch get bigger and bigger, the way we see much of our own world is distorted, often without many of us realizing. For example, when the Disney Corporation recently merged with ABC in America, it marked the further breakdown of the borders between news and entertainment, as one arm of the media corporation feeds off, promotes, and protects the other. American popular culture, with its full range from Bambi to Rambo, and its fascination with violence and the vacuous, now crosses these borders freely. Murdoch's empire now has access through satellite to two-thirds of the world's population. Star TV, of which he owns 64%, the satellite TV, stretches from Japan to Turkey, right across China, and India. Murdoch claims that direct satellite broadcasting is bringing a new dawn of free information and democracy to the third world and offers, and I quote him, an unambiguous threat to totalitarian regimes everywhere, unquote. Now, until recently, Murdoch's satellite carried BBC television news. And when the Chinese regime complained that unwelcome news was reaching far into China, Murdoch obliged and kicked the BBC off his satellite. His reward was not long in coming. The Murdoch organization has since linked up with the People's Daily, the mouthpiece of the Beijing regime, to sell information technology in China. As part of the deal, Murdoch is believed to have offered the Chinese government smart card technology that would allow television programs to be vetted before being broadcast. 90% of all the world's news comes from a handful of powerful Western sources. Three agencies, Associated Press, Reuters, and Agence France-Presse, dominate our foreign news. Reuters and AP now make huge profits selling financial and corporate information. Once they had proud records as news gatherers, today their newsrooms are centres of the free market crusade. AP gets most of its funding from American outlets and devotes most of its coverage to the United States. The former president of Tanzania, Julius Nyerere, once dryly suggested that the people of his country should be allowed to take part in the elections for President of the United States because they are bombarded with as much information about the candidates as Americans are. Yet only 1% of the news broadcast on the main American TV networks is about Africa. In television, there are just two huge agencies providing foreign news to all the world's newsrooms, Reuters Television and World Network Television, WTN. Reuters supplies 400 broadcasters in 85 countries, reaching an audience of 500 million people. Perhaps even more than Murdoch, the American company CNN, which is owned by the billionaire Ted Turner, is the model of the information age. Now, CNN, as you'll remember, made its reputation with its round-the-clock coverage of the Gulf War. It was CNN that we saw relayed both on ITV and BBC during that war. Indeed, who can forget the lit-up skies over Baghdad coming to us live and the excited commentators describing the accuracy of the new smart weapons and the preciseness of the surgical strikes, so precise that missiles could go around corners and so smart that they could distinguish bad people from good people. And we actually saw it happening on TV, or rather we thought we did. The message was certainly clear that war at last had become a science. And this was a war, according to the Independent newspaper, with miraculously few casualties. Long after the Gulf War, I remember quite vividly one surreal moment from television. I was slumped in front of the television late one night watching the BBC's arts program, The Late Show, which happened to be devoting an issue to foreign correspondents talking about their adventures in the Gulf War. As each one of them spoke, the background filled with images from the war itself, mostly tanks and artillery and missiles flashing in the night. Then quite suddenly the backdrop changed and there were bulldozers at work. And the reporter's monologue was overwhelmed by shocking pictures they couldn't see behind them. Driven by American soldiers, the bulldozers were pushing thousands of bodies into mass graves. Many of the bodies were crushed as if they'd been run over. Now, to my knowledge, the BBC's subversive blink was the only time the British public was allowed to see the true extent of the slaughter in the Gulf. The nature of the crime committed in the Gulf was never stated in the media. In the same way that 20 years after the war in Vietnam, it is extremely unusual to see or read in the media the truth that the United States attacked Vietnam, not went to save it. In the Gulf, as in Vietnam, the mass murder of people was passed off as tragic, perhaps even a mistake. Both were described as noble crusades. Last week, the Guardian carried a small item that said that only 8% of the weapons used in the Gulf War were so-called smart weapons, that the majority were what they call old-fashioned dump bombs. And we now know that most of them miss their military targets, killing thousands of men, women and children, many of them the very Shia and Kurd minorities that the West claimed to be defending. Those famous video pictures of American missiles blowing up Iraqi missile sites were all fake. Not a single Iraqi Scud site was destroyed. Millions of people dependent on Western satellite television were lied to, or the truth was simply left out. A total of 147 Allied soldiers died in the Gulf, most of them by accident. According to the most reliable studies, 200,000 Iraqis died during and immediately after the Allied attack, most of them civilians. This was never news. The media illusion of a clean, scientific war had triumphed, or rather, the unthinkable had been normalized. Now, the fact that the war continues today against the children of Iraq is also not news. The deaths of some 50,000 Iraqi children every year as a result of American and British-led sanctions is off the media agenda. It simply isn't news. And the fact that these sanctions are imposed in order to keep the price of oil in Saudi Arabia artificially low is also not of interest. I believe that one of the basic functions of the modern high-tech media is to normalize the unthinkable. This term comes from a fine essay by Edward Herman called The Banality of Evil. And for those who wish to know more about the modern media, I recommend it highly. As Herman wrote, and I quote, "Doing terrible things in an organized and systematic way rests on normalization. There is usually a division of labor in doing and rationalizing the unthinkable, with the direct brutalizing and killing done by one set of individuals and others working on improving technology, such as weapons or a new kind of napalm. But it is the function of the mainstream media to normalize the unthinkable for the general public." Unquote. Of course, this is not a new concept. Take the reporting of the Cold War. When President Kennedy declared in 1960 that there was a missile gap with the Soviet Union, his message was carried without question in the Western media. In fact, the opposite was true. America was actually well ahead in missile development, but Kennedy's successful propaganda gave new impetus to the Cold War. When the British government used Australia to test its nuclear weapons in the 1950s, the British and Australian media accepted the lie that the tests were safe and that no one was living in the test site when the bombs were exploded. In fact, many Aboriginal people lived there. The maps, which I saw later, had uninhabited stamped across them. More than that, the media actually celebrated, as I well remember, the contamination of the land and human lives as what they call progress. The front page of the now extinct Daily Graphic in London said, "A new nuclear future dawns for all of us." When President Johnson unleashed American bombers on North Vietnam in 1964, he did so only after the media had helped him to sell to Congress a cock and bull story that communist gunboats had attacked American ships in the seas off North Vietnam. On the basis of this lie, the greatest bombing in history followed, legitimizing the American invasion and the carnage of the next 10 years, in which at least 3 million people lost their lives. At the height of the pointless slaughter during the First World War, the British Prime Minister David Lloyd George told the editor of The Guardian, C.P. Scott, "If the public knew the truth, the war would end tomorrow, but they don't know and they can't know." Not a great deal has changed in principle. During the Falklands War in 1982, Margaret Thatcher's war, a plan put forward by Peru for a negotiated settlement with Argentina came close to success. How close, the public never knew. On May the 13th, 1982, Edward Heath told News at 10 that the Argentines had requested 3 minor amendments to the peace plan. The amendments were so minor, said Heath, that they couldn't possibly be rejected. But Thatcher rejected them, and the story died. And the invasion went on. Indeed, that brief interview with Heath was the only occasion on television news, both ITN and BBC, that reference was made to the Argentine amendments and the British government having a case to answer. ITN later claimed that 70% of the British public were in favour of an invasion, but what it left out from the same poll was that 76% wanted the United Nations to occupy the Falklands while Britain and Argentina negotiated. That was never news. During the miners' strike a few years later, television took on almost a Falklands role, with the miners often cast as the Argies. Picket line violence was the main media issue. When the strike was over, the National Council for Civil Liberties produced a report on the role of the police. The report said that, and I quote, "Contrary to the impression given by the media, most of the picketing during the strike had been orderly and on a modest scale." This was not reported. Today there's another so-called debate going on about the future of the BBC's World Service under John Burt. Anybody with a sense of decency opposes Burt's vandalism and his dismantling of the World Service. But what there's never been is a real debate about the myths surrounding the BBC as a public broadcaster, especially the one that it's touched by the beauty of truth, impartiality, and fair play. The BBC was started by John Reith, Lord Reith, while he was an enthusiastic propagandist for the Baldwin government during the general strike in the 1920s. To Reith, impartiality in broadcasting was a principle to be suspended whenever the establishment was threatened. And that holds true today. You need only look closely at the television coverage of the great upheavals of the last 10 or 15 years, the Falklands War, the miners' strike, Wapping, the Gulf War, the poll tax, Ireland, to see how faithfully the BBC has followed the Reithian code and how often with great subtlety and secrecy the unthinkable has often been normalised. For example, during the Falklands War, I was sent minutes of the BBC's weekly review board meeting, highly important top-level discussion of senior BBC executives. Now, these clearly showed those senior BBC executives directing that the reporting of the war be shaped, and I quote, "to suit the emotional sensibilities of the public," and that the weight of BBC coverage should be concerned with government statements of policy, and that an impartial style was felt to be, and I quote again, "an unnecessary irritation." Since the present Irish War began in 1968, several hundred major programmes on Ireland have been banned, censored, doctored, and delayed. From 1988, broadcast institutions and journalists accepted the outrageous censorship using actors' voices to blunt and demonise those who could have then played a part in peace and justice in Ireland. Even during the recent ceasefire, the British government's propaganda model was strictly adhered to. The underlying issues, such as poverty and the IUC's policing methods, were ignored. Decommissioning was made into a false issue, one which probably led the IRA to break the ceasefire. No mention was ever made of security force weaponry and the refortification of military installations. No mention was made of the increased intimidation of the people of Cross Maglen once the threat of the IRA was removed. The fact that the Labour Party under Blair radically changed its policy to fit exactly with that of the government was never an issue upon which Blair was ever vigorously challenged by journalists. These days, there's a sort of fantasy world in the reporting of politics in this country. The BBC employs 13 national and 19 regional political correspondents, all of them based at Millbank, just across from Parliament. You can see the MPs queuing up to be asked their predictable views. In an average week, these BBC political reporters churn out some 300 reports, all of them pretty well on the same theme, sticking to the same agenda set by two major political parties which are now virtually the same. The fact that they are the same and that the British people are now denied even the semblance of a democratic choice in parliamentary elections is simply not reported. Instead, TV, newspapers and radio are filled with a sort of political, daily political soap. Will John Major last the distance? Why does Tony Blair smack his children? What will Jack Straw say today that is more authoritarian than what he said yesterday? Pointless verbal fisticuffs are conducted on BBC radio and television with Gordon Brown and Kenneth Clark, who agree on everything except their God-given right to power. The Scott Inquiry provided the ammunition, but who, apart from Paul Foote and one or two others, have ever fired it? There is a new working class in this country that is being ruthlessly shaped by new forces of capital, but who in the mainstream media ever explains this? The consensus media view is that everyone is middle class now, apart from a small, irritating group known as the underclass. I do think it's time journalists did something about this. I know that there are many journalists who are troubled by their own place in the so-called media society, but are also worried about their jobs. There's no suggestion here of a conspiracy. Journalists are no different from historians and teachers in internalizing the priorities and fashions of power and of minimizing the culpability of power. But it's surely time that those journalists who work in the great media institutions analyze the myths and assumptions that influence everything they do, and that they begin to clear away the ideological rubble that buries so much real news and truth about the world. Ordinary journalists may not have the power of Murdoch or Burt, of course, but they are not powerless. They might begin by seeing themselves as agents of people, not agents of power, as participants, not innocent bystanders. In their own organizations, they can challenge, they can argue, and they can, if it comes to it, refuse. For instance, they can reclaim the language that is so casually abused these days. Words like reform and free market and democracy have become Orwellian jargon that cry out for decoding, not parroting. Take the word moderate, an old favorite that has long neatly divided those people acceptable and unacceptable to the establishment. Trade unionists are notoriously categorized in this way still. In the 1930s, the US government described Hitler as a moderate, standing between left and right in Germany. So was Mussolini a moderate, and Saddam Hussein was a moderate. Suharto, one of the great butchers of the late 20th century, is still called a moderate. Journalists use the terms globalization, humanitarian intervention, and preventative diplomacy as if they mean what they say. But what these are vital propaganda terms, euphemisms of a new imperialism, an imperialism that is seeking the same control over people and resources as ever before, but an imperialism that dares not speak his name. The word, of course, is never used. We have much to learn from journalists who struggle in a very different world from this one. I have many friends among them. One friend, Ahmad Taufik, is an Indonesian journalist who practices a sort of brave, non-conformist journalism that is faced with extinction in Britain. When Suharto closed down what was left of the liberal press in Jakarta, Taufik and his colleagues set up their own magazine called The Independent, a daring act in a country where free speech is against the law and dissenters are often murdered by the state. When I asked him if he was afraid, he said, "People will support us." And they did. They bought the brave paper in their thousands, and last year they crowded the courtroom where Taufik and his colleagues were sent to prison for 3 years for publishing an article that merely analysed the political situation in Indonesia uncritically. He must have known this would happen, and I offer his principled audacity as an example to journalists in the West who are not in fear of their lives. Perhaps I'm aiming these remarks at young journalists who too often, it seems to me, affect a sort of contrived, eclectic indifference which they confuse as sophistication and which they believe ordains them as real journalists. Some of them are convinced, sadly, that the public are apathetic and don't give a damn. They really should understand that the good journalist never takes refuge in cynicism, but persuades the readers to give a damn. I suppose my point is that people do give a damn and have a right to a press and a broadcasting that is theirs. I've been a journalist since I was 17 years old, and one thing I've had to learn is that people are always ahead of the media. These are the people who supported the miners, who supported the health workers and the postal workers, who have sustained the Liverpool dockers, who refused to pay the poll tax, who opposed going to war in the Gulf, and a majority in this country did, though this was hardly reported, and who despair that politics should be misrepresented as a choice between Tweedledum Major and Tweedledee Blair. So I offer the following as a media survival kit for young journalists and anyone else interested. Beware false objectivity, the kind that promotes an establishment agenda. Robert Louis Stevenson, not a known radical, as far as I can tell, but he once described, quote, those sham impartialists, wolves in sheep's clothing, simpering honestly as they suppress. Beware all news from official sources. As the great muckraker Claude Coburn once said, never believe anything until it's officially denied. Beware the pack. Never follow fashion in news. The stories crying out to be done are the ones almost always passed over. Recently, the Burmese democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi told me that her country and the epic struggle of its people had fallen victim to the fickle fashion of Western news. Beware all background briefings, especially from politicians. Indeed, try to avoid, where possible, all contact with politicians. That way you find out more about them. Certainly never go to work for them. Campaign to abolish the lobby system completely. Beware celebrating technology until you find out who controls it. The internet is brilliant, of course it is. But its most fervent bedfellows are the American government and a cluster of multinational companies whose message posting is outstripping all others. Have nothing to do with what are known as D-notices. Go to jail if necessary. And always understand that all journalism, should be investigative, be it politics, economics, sport, the lot. And finally, take pride in the knowledge that the media barons can't stand the sight of us journalists. Rupert Murdoch's contempt for journalists is well known, and Conrad Black's regard for journalists is as follows. Black, of course, is the one who owns the Daily Telegraph here and newspapers and television stations all over the world and likes to boast that he's even more right-wing than Murdoch. The trouble with journalists, says Black, is that their mental stability is open to question. They are ignorant, lazy, and inadequately supervised. And they depend on stifling and depraved gossip and the fawning of hucksters and unfulfilled women. Unquote. The women journalists, I suppose, depend on unfulfilled men. Alas, he named names, and I confess, not without pride, that mine was one of them. Journalists and broadcasters can be and should be the guardians of history. The best write history's first draft. Ed Murrow, the great American reporter, repels smear upon smear in his reporting of the McCarthy witch hunts in the United States. Martha Gellhorn reported the disaster of the Great Depression from the point of view of its victims in the heartland of America. James Cameron broke the silence over the Korean War and exposed the atrocities on our side. Morgan Phillips Price, the Guardian's man in Moscow in 1917, was damned as a traitor for reporting the Allied invasion that did its best to strangle the revolution at birth, and there are many more like them. The great essayist Raymond Williams once referred to those writers and journalists who, as he put it, endlessly harp about the end of idealism. "This is all they have," he wrote, "with which to defend this social order. Not that it's good, but that it's inevitable." Nothing is inevitable. It is possible to read between the lines, as my Czech friend advised long ago, but it's hard to do that as an isolated individual. It can be done in communication and solidarity with others. As for those of us in the media, I suggest we listen to the wisdom of a primary school teacher, Pat Hartington, who stood up at her union's conference and called on her colleagues to protect children from the onslaught of government policies. She said, and I quote, "The future is in our hands whether we change the law or not, because by resisting we will refine, by subverting we will redirect, and by protecting we will create. And in doing so, we remain loyal to the principle that the learner and truth and equality come first." I can add nothing to that. Thank you.
Right, I'm going to take Tash Shiffrin as the first speaker. Just to remind speakers that they've got 3 minutes, and after that I'll give you a reminder to sum up if you go over. Just before Tash speaks, though, I've got an urgent message for a Mrs. Joanne Lucy to phone your daughter urgently at home. So if she's here, can you do that? Also, a question to John or anybody else from Naomi Wimborne Idrissi. What is your view on the role of international news agencies? I work for Reuters and know many correspondents aim to cover their beats with integrity. Are their intentions frustrated by the organisations that they work for? Right, if Tash Shiffrin can be the first speaker, and she'll be followed by Sarah Finnegan.
Right, comrades, so I want to say something about the much vaunted role of spin doctors who have become a kind of a fashionable trend, and we're always hearing about like the Labour Party's spin doctors and how powerful they are. These people sit in a little room somewhere down in Walworth Road and they phone up the BBC and they phone up the papers, and magically, you know, the words of Tony Blair appear in the papers and on screen, and there's a sort of a mythology that arises around these people that they're somehow firstly manipulating the media, and secondly, by doing that, controlling what people think. And I just want to sort of say a couple of things about that. Sadly, for my sins, I've been working in a press office until last Thursday, and being in that situation, albeit at a much, much lower level, I think you learn a little bit about who does and who doesn't actually control the media and control what goes into it. Firstly, just to deal with the sort of, you know, the big political kind of spin doctors like Mandelson and what's his name, is it Alistair Campbell, Blair's press secretary? you know, you hear all this stuff about how Alistair Campbell's got a bit for Blair in the Sun, half a page of Tony Blair says whatever. And I just think it's very important for comrades to remember, firstly, that, you know, who actually owns the media? You know, the Rupert Murdochs, and so on that John Pilger was talking about. But secondly, actually, I think if we suggest that Alistair Campbell is directing it, we're putting the cart before the horse. I think we need to recognise that Blairism is a phenomenon, that Blair is someone who is out to prove to the ruling class that he can do a good job of making sure that Britain stays or gets profitable or something and keep the workers under wraps. A lovely little relationship has been going on. Tony Blair's flown off to go and see Rupert Murdoch. You know, they sit down and have dinner. Rupert Murdoch's very interested in Tony Blair. That's actually why Tony Blair is getting space in the Sun. You know, if Tony Cliff could offer something really useful to Rupert Murdoch, he'd probably get half a page in the Sun as well. For obvious reasons, you know, it doesn't work like that. The second thing that I just want to say is, the other thing that I think we need to bear in mind is that people's ideas are not wholly shaped by the media. They're not wholly shaped by what gets pumped out from, you know, from offices and people's political phone calls and stuff. They're actually shaped, you know, by obviously people get a lot of ideas from the media, but those ideas can clash with the ideas that we get from reality. I've been working in Hackney Council's press office. It's a very, very sad job, to be honest. It's the most socially useless job you could possibly do for a council, is sit on the phone and explain to journalists, or try and explain to journalists, why shutting libraries is a good idea. This is supposed to be improving the image of the council, and because we weren't doing it well enough, that's why I stopped last Thursday. And in between... And in between that, you know, we find them sort of recruiting private consultants at £300 a day. He actually was called a spin doctor, a nasty bloke called Neil Martinson, with lots of local Labour Party connections, as it goes. You know, because they think these people are going to change the council's image. I'll tell you, it's bollocks. There must be people here who live in Hackney or have been to Hackney. You know that the council houses are falling down. You know they're being sold off to the private sector. You know that 7 libraries have shut. You know that a school is shut. You know that Meals on Wheels are being replaced by frozen dinners. People in Hackney know that, and that reality will always conflict with whatever garbage people pump out to the press. And I really want to finish there. I think we need to bear in mind that actually we can challenge where these people are coming from. They don't exist in isolation from society. They're part of a class system. They're part of the politics that are built on that. Actually, we can challenge those ideas.
Right, Sarah Finnegan will be followed by Theresa Hines.
Yeah, I think John Peel just talked about Rupert Murdoch, and I think when Blair goes to meet Rupert Murdoch, Rupert Murdoch's the man who smashed workers at Wapping, but now also we find out tonight that he's the man that sells smart cars to China to vet television programmes. It really tells us two things about Blair, really. Blair isn't just going to attack workers, but now it tells us really what Blair thinks about democracy. But... You see, there is an argument that the media is all powerful and we're not going to change society because people are duped by the media and they won't fight back. But as the last speaker said, that's not true. And if you think about the fact that the majority of Sun readers vote Labour and not Tories, as it's a Tory paper... You can understand that. And I think it is clear that if everyone knew what we know tonight and what we've been told by John Pilger tonight, we maybe will be in a better position to change society because people would understand more the ruthless drive for profit of the ruling class. And yet, despite the fact that people don't know this, they do fight back. You've got the postal workers on strike now, and I talked to one, and he was... saying that, you know, a lot of people in his post office read The Sun, and they were reading that, oh, they've just turned down a 15% pay rise, full stop. And they can see quite clearly that that's not true, and there's a lot more to it than that. You have also The Sun reporting on the Hillsborough tragedy, and a lot of people in Liverpool, after their terrible reporting, refused to buy The Sun. So those two factors, I think, the fact that the media is owned by and large by the ruling class. And the other fact that despite this, workers do fight back. I think that's the reason why paper like Socialist Worker is so important, really, because it not only tells us what the Tories are up to and how corrupt and they are, it not only tells us how Labour are complicit in that and how what the Labour Party are up to, but it also tells, it supports all working class struggles, so that workers who read Socialist Worker know what, how, you know, the of other struggles that other workers are fighting.
Please,
and really,
wind up now, please.
It's, I mean, it's a tool that is essential, really, for us to organise and have be in a better position to fight back and fight for a better society.
Before I call the next speaker, I've got another question from Adam Williamson from Edinburgh University. What is the solution to the undeniable apathy of readers? How can we make people prefer to hear about the poverty gap over Diana? Teresa Hines will be the next speaker, followed by Chris Nynham. I'm going to tap on the microphone, by the way, just to give you warning to start winding up, just so we can keep the discussion really tight. So, Teresa.
Just what isn't reported in the British media, I think it's easy to criticize journalists for what you don't think isn't reported, but I think it's also important to realize that, as John Pilger mentioned, that many journalists are stuck in jobs where they're compelled by their newspaper's party line. What is demanded of them. For example, this past spring, because I'm writing a thesis about journalists at the five national broadsheets, which are the Times, Guardian, Financial Times, Daily Telegraph, and the Independent, I interviewed them about what they thought about homelessness and the big issue and what their coverage was of those topics. What is really frightening is I found that, unlike my expectations, not all reporters at the conservative papers were specifically conservative reporters, and also most of the reporters I spoke with said they were really constrained by what was demanded of them by their editors. For example, several journalists I talked to from the Times, one of the questions I asked them 14 questions. I said, what do you find is the biggest challenge about being a journalist? One young reporter about my age at the Times said, my biggest challenge is to justify to people why I work for something published by Rupert Murdoch. But what is also really disturbing is that I asked them, when they get ideas about homelessness to write about, what are the editor's response to those? The same reporter at the Times, he saw an article on the big issue about kids who take their methadone prescriptions and vomit them and in turn sell them to other kids who are addicted to them. He proposed this idea to editors at the Times and they just laughed out of his face. What I also found, I spoke with other journalists at the other papers, including the Daily Telegraph. One reporter told me, quote, homelessness isn't a sexy item. Our readers don't want to hear about it. But what I also found surprisingly is that a lot of journalists are really constrained about what to write. For example, you might think that journalists at papers like the Daily Telegraph might be very conservative themselves. What I found is specifically one young woman, about my age again, who described herself as very leftist. She talked about the party line that she hated, and she told me about her job. She works during the day at the Daily Telegraph, reports what is expected of her, and at night promptly leaves for a second job in an alternative London magazine. So I think what I'd like to point out is that not all journalists are just unthinking people just writing, just continually just, you know, not listening to society. Many are constrained in their jobs, and that's why I think it's important that groups like the SWP not only support these journalists because they understand what's going on in society, but quite frankly, it's very competitive and they have to keep their jobs. So it's important that we not only support them, but there also needs to be the need for alternative papers like the Socialist Worker, which reports things that we don't often see in the mainstream media.
Chris Nyland will be followed by Christina Rowe.
John was brilliant about how the establishment controls the media, but I think even the Tories recognise sometimes that the media doesn't control us. At the last round of party political broadcast, it was a few months ago, beginning of this year actually, the Tories actually decided not to take up their option on a party political broadcast on all the channels, presumably, and this was actually reported in the press, presumably because they knew that no one was going to believe a word of what they said. And I think that's, you know, that this is something we do have to come back to time and time again, really, because it's quite easy to con people. I mean, even this wasn't complete by any means, but it's quite easy to con people about something that's going on, a war that's going on, you know, a couple of thousand miles across the globe or whatever. But when it comes to the reality of everyday life and people's experience, it's much, much harder for the media. And to be honest, even the tabloids, even the Tory tabloids, have gone through quite a few transformations in the last few years. I mean, we had a period a little while ago when, the Major and the Tory hierarchy were absolutely up in arms against the tabloids because the tabloids seemed to be turning on them left, right and centre. I mean, you had story after story about, you know, sleaze and corruption and about big bucks going into the boardrooms and so on and so forth. Why was that? It's because in the end of the day, you know, the media has to sell, and even those scumbags who run those sort of newspapers recognise that there is this massive anger against what is happening to people, that people experience in their everyday life, and they had to relate to that. People have mentioned, you know, Blair loving up to Murdoch and how disgusting it is. Of course it's disgusting. And one of the worst things I think about it is that he uses, and the Labour leadership, use this whole argument that the media is all powerful, therefore we've got to get into the media, therefore people shouldn't fight back, we've got to be respectable, we've got to, not go on strike, we've got to make sure we don't go on demonstrations and so on and so forth. They use that as an argument against anyone who wants to fight back. And the problem is, that reinforces the power of ruling class ideas, I think. Because I think ruling class ideas are at their strongest when people on the ground are passive, are atomised, when we're just going about our everyday life, you know, and we don't see any sort of alternative. I think when ruling class ideas, the media's sort of ideas, can be challenged best is when people are fighting back and beginning to look for some sort of alternative. The last time there was any, you know, really serious wave of working class struggle, you know, massive wave of working class struggle in this country in the early 70s, the media, you know, as it always does, ran a massive campaign against strike action, against militants and so on and so forth. It just didn't work. It ended up in a situation where the Sun newspaper actually had to support the miners' strike in 1974 that brought down the Tory government because it was such a popular strike. And it ended up in a situation as well where workers began to produce their own media, to be honest, because they were so fed up with the kind of lies that were being produced. You know, there were rank and file newspapers produced. Even the TUC actually had to produce an alternative news service because it was demanded by the rank and file to counter the lies of the media. And best of all, that wave of strike action in the early 70s had its impact on the media itself. You had a situation when the dockers went on strike in 1972. Yeah, I'm finishing now. When the dockers went on strike in 1972, one of the very first things they did was to march up to Fleet Street down the road, go and talk to the shop stewards in Fleet Street, and after 24 hours of arguing, they got the printers out on strike and they stopped the media's lies.
Just before I take the next speaker, there's a comment to be asked to be read out from Pam Johnson from the IS in Canada, who says, Conrad Black has referred to layoffs in his organisation as drowning the kittens. Right, Christina Rowe will be followed by Chidem Otbas. Is Christina here? Right, I'll call Chidem next, followed by Greg Shalice.
All right, Socialist İşçi is the name of our paper in Turkey. Our comrades is producing it. Now, when I was in Turkey in 1990, I took the legal responsibility of this paper. I was a legal editor of this paper. When I took the responsibility, I thought that ruling class thinks that the socialism is dead, because they were shouting, oh, socialism is dead, no Russia anymore, Eastern Europe is collapsed, and new world order, hurrah, nothing, no problem, the history is finished, yeah, everything is all right. And I thought they are not going to bother us, at least for a while, because we are too small, then why they should bother about us? And I was easy. And then I realized that they started to call me to the court for every issue, and I got 1.5 years sentencement out of this. And really, why Turkish state is scared of this small organization, and this paper is being produced by only a couple of hundred people? Because there is such a crisis. Hundreds of thousands of people demonstrated, rioted against the police, and they marched to the parliament to push their trade union leadership and the social democrats not to sell out. They managed to collapse. That this is the second government they managed to get rid of from the government, and they are really scared that we will articulate this anger. They know that. I think they learned from the history as well, in terms of how the socialist literature, how the alternative literature can make an can play an important role. Like John Pilger said, people, in terms of the ordinary working class people, are ahead of what media is talking about. Because when we use the news, especially from the contemporary daily papers, in terms of not to get in trouble with the state, because of the content, because of how we really put that news in front of the people, that we are being prosecuted. Anyway, now I want to make sure that this bloody ruling class and bureaucrats or the judges are gonna be dead. Care to Ted that, yeah? And to be able to do that, we need help, comrades, because a few hundreds of people wouldn't be able to pay that huge thousands of pounds, really, pounds. I'm not talking about Turkish lira. And you need to take the resolutions to your trade union branches, and you need to raise money for us, because we want to make sure that we will have a different world altogether internationally. We don't want to have a defeated revolution next time. Please take your draft resolutions from the Socialist Işçi stall in Institute Bar. Thank you.
Just before I take Greg, another question from Laurel Wingfield. How much did media coverage have to do with the jingoism over Euro 96? How much already existed before the hysteria in the Mirror and other papers? Right, Greg will be followed by, I'm afraid I can't read this name very well, it looks like Alex from Reclaim the Streets.
Yeah, John Pilger referred to the lamentable coverage by the media of the Falklands War, and of course that, you know, is absolutely the case, but of course it's a sight easier for them to get away with that kind of coverage, given the fact that the Labour Party didn't do anything to oppose it. You know, if they'd have been getting up in Parliament and speaking out against the Falklands War, then obviously it would have been much harder for them to give the totally one-sided view, and the same goes for Ireland as well. And what I want to address is the question that's already been touched upon, is about really how and to what extent do the media succeed in duping people, because the point has been made that it is easier for the media to mislead and distort things when it comes to subjects which, you know, people don't have direct experience of and don't feel familiar with. And that's why, as socialists, we do say that the struggle is the key, really, in challenging the power of the media. And I'm called to mind an example from my workplace, the Sheffield Star, where there was a strike last summer by the library workers opposing attempts by the council to change their terms and conditions, and the Star ran editorials attacking them for being on strike and distorting what was going on and refusing to put over their view, and union spokespeople weren't getting their point of view into the paper. And despite all of that, the strike won, and so the local Unison branch thought that they put an advert in the paper saying that, you know, victory to the library workers, come along to a meeting to celebrate it type of thing. And the management at the newspaper, in their wisdom, decided that they couldn't run that advert because that was just the union's opinion that it was a victory, and, you know, they weren't into... It's funny, isn't it? You know, you sell these adverts for cars, you know, it goes faster, it's better, you know, best carpets, whatever it is. But you can't, if you can't have an opinion if you're in a trade union. The great thing was that the library workers converged outside the Sheffield Star office, and they're all chanting liar, liar, liar outside the editor's office. And one of them had a placard down there, and it said, I thought this was brilliant, twinkle, twinkle, Sheffield Star, now we see just what you are. You know, likewise, on the, you know, another example of where struggle in the miners' strike. Thinking back to the miners' strike, I mean, people say, "What's the best front page the Sun ever did?" Was it Freddie Starr ate my hamster and all that sort of rubbish? But the best front page ever did by a mile was the one that was blanked out by the NGA when they tried to print a picture of Scargill, and that's an example that we can still look to. Now, I mean, the other example that I wanted to give as well, and this is something that, I mean, you know, we were delighted to welcome John Pilger to Marxism, and also to say, like, the, you know, that he was part of Media Workers Against the Nazis, and through Media Workers Against the Nazis, you know, we did campaign and we did change the atmosphere inside the media so that those journalists that wanted to expose and wanted to oppose the Nazis were more able to stand up, and we did that through petitioning and campaigning on the ground. So, I mean, I believe really that what we've got to look to, as well as, you know, the hidden power of the media, if they want, is the hidden power of media workers, because there's more power now, you know, concentrated amongst media workers probably, you know, than ever before. You know, the spread of the media empire, I do have to say that the spread of the media empire... I do have to say that on the question of the spread of the media empire, it's interesting that Tony Blair's attitude to this was to was not to oppose the extension of cross-media ownership, so he could, you know, crawl up Murdoch's backside, and Murdoch rewarded him by closing down the only pro-Labour newspaper in Fleet Street, which was Today. Whether or not Blair will learn any lessons for that is another matter, but, you know, there's been a long recent history of attacks on the unions inside the media, and on our union, the NUJ in particular. And what I think is that there's a massive amount of paranoia on the part of the bosses. You know, every time they see two or three people talking to one another in our office, you know, it gets them shitting themselves. They can't bear the idea that people are organising. And the fact is that the media workers now, and journalists, I would say, are more like workers than they ever have been before. You know, it's more of a production line inside there. And John's right to make an appeal to journalists to say, you know, you should stand up for what is right, and you should tell the truth and all the rest of it. But I'll tell you, people aren't measured on that in local newspapers. They're measured on how much stuff they can knock out. Bollock it on is the message, you know, that they're interested in is production. What they're interested in is getting the paper out, and people aren't judged on the quality of what they put out, but merely, and so in that sense, you know, it is a production line, and people are under incredible stress, and problems with RSI and all the rest of it mean that, you know, there is the power there. If we have no power, then I cannot understand, for one, why it is that the bosses constantly attack our union. Why don't they just, you know, consign us to the dustbin of history? They can't do that. We're still here. And, I believe that that workers inside the media will have their day as well.
Alex McAllister, it looks like, will be followed by Mike Simons.
I've got less of a point to make rather than a question of how we implement any alternative. We all seem to know what we don't want, but not how to make what we do want. And whether, if you want to reform the media, whether it would be the question of whether it's from above or whether it's from below, whether you legislate to disallow monopolies or just try and encourage and foster grassroots papers like School and Green Line People to make their own news, and is the responsibility on the individual to do the reporting themselves through talking to other people, through making papers in their own communities, or whether rather than say that there is any possible way of getting a truer version of news is to ask us all to question everything we read, whether we should all foster an analysis and read between the lines of every single thing we read, even stuff of John Pilger's, because everybody has a philosophy, everybody has an agenda. And you may agree with that agenda or you may not, but the whole point is that you should be conscious that they have one. And how do you encourage people to do that? How do you make that more prevalent, that attitude towards your news and your media? That's all.
Just before Mike, I've got a question from Christina Rowe, who just wanted this read out. Is there any way, in your opinion, that the truth can be conveyed, and how can an ordinary member of the public put pressure on media moguls to change their tack? Mike Simons will be followed by Johnny Clark.
Right, I think it's brilliant that we have radical journalists like John Pilger who coming here. I think it's really one of the most sickening things is the way the space for those radical journalists has been squeezed out. You know, what's happened to the Daily Mirror? What happened to Paul Foote and John Pilger? And I don't know, maybe you look at something like the New Labour, New Statesman, how that's been taken over. I seem to see John's column getting squeezed and squeezed in there and put further back in the paper. Maybe that's going to get squeezed as well. But as other speakers have said, it's not all gloom, because the media isn't all powerful, and the media owners aren't all powerful. Though there is tremendous power amongst media workers. There's tremendous alienation amongst media workers. I find that as a journalist for Socialist Worker, when you get, you know, we're very, very different to the rest of the press. But when you actually get into a decent conversation with a lot of journalists, they hate the way that they're made to work and the distortions. But what I would say is, because the ruling class rule by both fraud and force, the newspaper industry is part of the fraud, although it has to reflect the realities. The fact that they have to use fraud, it has to reflect the realities, creates a space in which we can have our own press, our own media, and that's the space in which Socialist Worker operates, in which working class papers operate, and we can report exactly the omissions. Now, John talked about the omissions from Fleet Street. We do report the omissions from the mainstream media. And the Liverpool Dockers are sitting up here is a classic example. But just about every industrial dispute, you'd only see in Socialist Worker that's where the worker's case is put across. We can actually deal with the way the news is presented, or that total fragmentation. You watch the news sometimes over recent months, and you see one item's about BSE, one item's about famine, the next item is about football fans knifing a German, you know, Europhobia, and no one links links the things together. But of course they're absolutely connected, and the paper a socialist newspaper can do that. It can be a paper that wears its bias quite openly on its sleeve. You know, we don't hide behind the phony neutrality of Fleet Street. We wear our bias on our sleeve. We're for human liberation. We're for the workers' victory. And of course, the most important thing that it does above all that is a socialist paper, independent. I think it was Karl Marx who said the first freedom of the press is not being in business. A socialist worker supported by the by workers can actually begin to organise the fight back as well. It can build up a network of readers and activists who understand what's going on and support each other's struggles. It can make concrete networks of solidarity. So it's not just a bit of information and a good argument going in dropped into a pool. It's something concrete there. It can take up all the struggles that need to be fought, the fight against oppression, a fight against exploitation. It can take up the internationalist issues. And really, we do want more and more radical journalists inside the mainstream press. I think one of the best ways we can do that is creating a movement, a real fight back in Britain, which inspires them to fight. At the same time, that runs absolutely parallel with it is the strengthening of our own papers, and really, you know, getting Socialist Worker read, getting it distributed, making sure it's on very, very firm foundations. And in that way, whenever there's a clash between illusion of the mainstream media and the reality. We've got an explanation that people can get and go for.
Right, the next speaker will be Johnny Clark, and after that I'm going to take the final speaker. We've had a lot of speaker slips in, but unfortunately we're running out of time. So the final speaker will be Fred Hamilton after Johnny.
Yeah, I just want to bring you back to that time, at the time of the pit closures, because it's been one of the most exciting examples of how we can turn the whole thing around. One of the things that you noticed at the time of pit closures, that people, and John Pilger mentioned earlier, that people were well ahead of the press, and suddenly people were really, really angry with what was going on. And suddenly you saw a shift in the national papers, because they had to some extent respond to it. But really what was the most exciting thing was the Daily Mirror at the time, because the Daily Mirror had a front page which said, coal not dull, and it was absolutely exciting, and the idea that suddenly you saw a massive shift. But the thing is, it links in with the paper Socialist Worker and how we organise, because the truth of the matter is, not only was there a general anger, but there was actually disputes amongst media workers at the Daily Mirror. There were socialists in the Daily Mirror, and I don't think it's any accident that many of the people that were putting forward the arguments, coal not dull, talking about the pit closures, talking about what the Tories were doing with the industry and all the rest of it, were actually people who were involved with Socialist Worker and probably read Socialist Worker, sold Socialist Worker inside the Mirror and other places. And that's precisely the point I think we've got to make. What we've got to say about journalists: if you want to be an honest journalist, you've got to be a committed journalist. You can't simply describe the world in which you live, you've got to be a part of changing the world in which you live. And that is the exciting prospect. And that's why Socialist Worker is not an alternative newspaper. It's a way of organising, mobilising working class people up and down the country, in every workplace, in every industry, to be able to put once and for all the whole of the lies and the distortion and the ideology that keeps us under the foot of capitalism.
Right, the final speaker will be Fred Hamilton from ASLEF RMT.
Good evening, comrades. My name is Fred Hamilton. I belong to both the train crew unions, that's the ASLEF and the RMT. I work on the Northern Line, and I'm sure a lot of you know about the Northern Line. I belong to the East Finchley Depot. I've got to offer you all a very, very personal apology, because there's not going to be much of a service tomorrow on the Underground. And in spite of what you read in the Evening Standard tomorrow evening, there will still not be much of a service at 5 o'clock either. Basically, that what you have read in the Evening Standard and other daily papers so far has been a total pack of lies, for want of a better word. They've always focused that the nasty train crew, who are getting an awful lot of money for doing a very small amount of work, want even more money for doing even less work. Well, that was never our argument in the first place. We are quite happy with the money we're receiving, surprisingly enough. We just want a reduction in our working week, which was promised to us last year. So what we are going out on strike for, for the last 3 weeks and tomorrow, and for the next 8 weeks, is something that was promised to us last year, which was never delivered. Now, if any of you wish to help in the cause, you're quite welcome to join any picket lines at any train depots on any of the London Underground stations. And that's more or less all I've got to say. Thank you for listening to me.
Before I ask John to come back on some of the questions and to sum up, I've got four announcements. So if comrades can just bear with me and listen to the announcements. As the last speaker just said, there will be a tube strike tomorrow, but there will also be a postal worker strike tomorrow as well. And there's a message to all London branches to make sure that they cover both strikes from early in the morning. The tube strike, incidentally, starts at midnight tonight, so people travelling... Which is when?
Sorry to correct you, Chair Lady. The tube strike starts at what is commonly called close of traffic, which is not midnight. It can be as late as 1:30, depending where about you are on the system. So don't believe the Tory press on anything, okay?
Right, thank you. So just make sure you leave enough time to get home. Right, secondly, all London branches are to collect papers from outside room 2DEF in Yulu, if you haven't done so already. Thirdly, there'll be any changes in the new timetable are going to be available on a sheet that will be distributed outside the meeting at the end of the meeting tonight. So that's tomorrow's timetable changes will be available at the end of the meeting outside. Finally, a timetable change. Chris Bambury will be speaking on Churchill at 2:00 tomorrow in the Badminton Court. That replaces the meeting on the dialectics of nature. Interesting. Right, John, if you'd like to sum up.
A couple of these speakers, refers directly, does imply the great apathy amongst people, which I think the speakers have addressed extremely well. There isn't an apathy. It's a myth. But it's a really potent myth, and you hear it all the time. And I think even one of the speakers mentioned it, that, this question is, how can we make people prefer to hear about the poverty gap over Diana? Well, it's not the last crumbling edifices of the royal family is, of course, news. It depends how it's written. I think we're probably beginning to see the beginning of the end of the royal family, which is excellent news. So why not? Let's have that. But as one of the other speakers mentioned, there are connections between those, and it really is up to journalists to, as I mentioned before, to persuade people to give a damn. People do give a damn passionately. I've worked only for popular media most of my career. Yes, although I am just in front of food in the New Statesman at the moment. I worked for many years for the Daily Mirror. I make documentaries for ITV. I made a documentary about a place that hardly anybody had heard of. A few years ago, called East Timor, and after that, British Telecom reliably reported that we had 4,000 people ringing every minute, and they rang until 3:00 in the morning, and it went on not at that rate, but almost at that rate for a couple of days. Now I can remember when the Mirror did issues like Coal Not Dole. And its great, great, great shock issues, is this the promised land across the front page, or as others that I was involved with, whole issues devoted to what was happening in Cambodia and so on, they sold out. People couldn't get them. When the Sun was peddling its rubbish during the Falklands War, with mocking the violent deaths of Argentinian conscripts and fabricating the story of an interview with the widow of a British soldier, its circulation went down, and the Mirror, which had very measured editorials, which reflected the deep misgivings, at the very least, the deep misgivings in this country about that task force going into the South Atlantic, its circulation went up. And I was talking to a former editor that I worked under for many years, Mike Malloy, the other day, and he was reminding me that whenever the Mirror kept its nerve and didn't try to descend to the Sun's ground, its circulation remained steady. That one of the things that beat it, of course, was the Sun undercut it in price, went for a kind of... Went for a marketing campaign that the Mirror didn't compete with. There were commercial reasons that way, but the point was that every time the Mirror supported its readers and supported the working people of this country, which it had represented for many years and which it became, in representing them, became the biggest selling daily newspaper in the Western world, at its best, that was in the 1960s. By its very nature and by its quality and by its link with its readers, absolutely destroyed the myth of apathy. It doesn't exist. And when journalists talk about, you know, as you hear this sort of mock cynicism about the lowest common denominator we have to appeal to, and the lowest common denominator is often sitting in the editor's chair, you know. How much did media coverage, well, it's related, have to do with the jingoism around Euro 96? I don't think there was a lot of jingoism around Euro 96. Everybody enjoyed it. You know, for once, England won a few games. It was incredible. You know, and I think people were so stunned at first, and then they got on and enjoyed it. I don't think there was any. Yes, there's going to be a bit of fairly harmless stuff for supporting the home side or whatever, but who cares? I didn't think it was jingoism. I thought all the jingoism was in the Mirror and the Sun. And I thought, again, if you think people were jingoistic, the reaction to that came from ordinary people. The Press Complaints Commission, or whatever it's called these days, was inundated with complaints, not from Lord so-and-so and the usual angry of Tunbridge Wells, but from ordinary people who were outraged that their papers, and they are their papers, tabloids are the papers of working people. The fact that people are disenfranchised as far as newspapers are concerned is another matter. But they are their papers. They don't want The Guardian, rightly so. You know, they want their papers. The fact that they're given only McDonald's means they only read only McDonald's, if that's not too loose an analogy. People complained about that. I don't think there was jingoism. There is a tremendous newspaper tradition and journalism tradition in Britain. I've certainly made it... one of the reasons I made it my home was because of that. And there are many, many fine journalists. Journalists who work in extraordinary conditions, as one of the speakers mentioned, the RSI pressures, pressures in regional newspapers and local newspapers, etc. But still, they come up with stories that cause, at the very least, the most serious embarrassment to the establishment and often rock its very foundations. The investigations that have gone into a number of things, I could reel them off from the SAS operation in Gibraltar, right through to Seamus Milne's expose of how the British state moved against the miners and so on and so forth. There are fine journalists. They certainly need their support. It's very difficult for them. 80% of the NUJ's membership are now freelancers, which is extraordinary. It was the other way around when I was on the Mirror. And that means that journalism, like everything else, has been casualized. To get a job, you were given a job. You were given a tryout, a contract for a couple of months, even as a senior sub-editor. And during that time, you have to compete with somebody else who's also trying out for the job. And the one that wins gets the job. You know, the same things that apply right across industry and everywhere now in this country are bedeviling journalists. It means they can't think in terms, often, of the long term, of the long investigation that's going to bear fruit. Rightly or wrongly, they look to television now for the sort of investigations that cost money. The sort of investigations that I do abroad, I could never do on newspapers now. It's only television that will support them, and that's precarious as well. So there are a lot of problems for journalists, but as I said earlier, and a number of speakers reiterated, that journalists can make a difference. They can stand up. If a few journalists had voted not to go to Wapping for the Times and the Sunday Times, the whole operation wouldn't have stalled, but it would have been seriously impeded. I mean, Murdoch himself said, for the first time, the journalists could have made a difference if they'd refused to go to Wapping. And to their credit, many refused. Of course, many did go. Most of those on the Sun went. So it's the old story, isn't it, of standing up and standing together. And that applies to journalists as well as to the rest of us. Anyway, thank you for letting me speak tonight.